Tonight I want to talk a little bit about the new English version of the Emeijuku Kunangyo on page 6. And I will just read it once in English briefly. Absorbing world sounds awakens a Buddha right here. This Buddha, the source of compassion. This Buddha receives only compassion. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, just compassion. Thus the pure heart always rejoices. In the light, recall this. In the dark, recall this. Moment after moment, the true heart arises. Time after time, there is nothing but this. So, this piece is actually, this is an invocation of Kanzeon. Kanzeon, that word, is the Japanese name for the Bodhisattva of compassion, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva of compassion, which is the kind of great transcendent being who embodies the awakened virtue of compassion. So she's called Kanzeon in Japanese, also Kanon is her nickname in Japanese, and Guanyin or Kuanyin are Chinese, and Avalokiteshvara in Sanskrit. And these words, Kanzeon and Avalokiteshvara, mean the one who beholds or absorbs the sounds of the world. The one, and this is kind of a mixed sensory modality thing. This isn't the one who hears the sounds of the world. This is the one who sees and is called forth by all of the sounds, all of the cries of the suffering world. This is the one who turns her, his regard to really look at the truth of suffering beings. This is an invocation, and in Buddhism, these Bodhisattva Mahasattvas are not beings out there. They are kind of images for qualities of ourselves. And so, in an important way, the Emeijuku Kunangyo is an invocation of ourselves as Kanzeon. And this practice of absorbing world sounds is it's related to one practice we sometimes do in meditation of listening. And this is not the listening where the mind goes out and follows after the sounds. This is listening that is receiving everything that comes in, receiving ourselves, receiving the world, receiving difficult states of mind, difficulties in the world, letting it all in. Nothing about our practice in Zen is turning away. Our practice is always turning towards. This is a practice of allowing and receiving and absorbing. The sounds of the world come towards us and fall inward, ultimately replacing us. So, absorbing world sounds, beholding the suffering of the world, beholding the suffering of our blindly passionate selves, awakens a Buddha right here. The practice of turning towards compassion, the practice of turning towards suffering is the thing that gives rise to awakening, which is freedom amid suffering, not freedom from suffering. Nothing, sorry to say, nothing in Buddhism frees you from suffering. But there is something real. There is something that is freedom. There is something that enables you to be with suffering in a different way, to be amid suffering and not suffer so much, and to suffer so much and not suffer so much. And this is what this practice supports. And part of what this practice is enabling us to be able to respond more flexibly, more skillfully, with kindness to difficult circumstances that arise in us, and maybe provoke anger or aversion or the stories we tell ourselves. And that all of these things, these energies of grasping, aversion, and ignorance, still arise. But having arisen, we have more choice in how we interact with them. And that is what being awake, in the way we use it, means. So, absorbing world sounds awakens a Buddha right here. And this is also a oneness, a statement of oneness, of really taking responsibility for our own lives, for the whole catastrophe, and for really being the person we mean to be. This Buddha, the source of compassion. So, compassion. Compassion isn't something. It isn't something special that we do special practices to be able to generate. Compassion is what arises naturally from seeing how much pain and angst and grief we experience when we get caught up with our stories of grasping, aversion, and ignorance. When we get caught up in our habit energies, in our reactivity to the world, and we see that that is more painful for us, you know, and in the way the Buddha's image for this is reaching out, that reacting in anger is reaching out and grabbing up a hot coal in order to throw it at somebody who offends you. And the first thing that happens is you're going to burn your hand. And then you throw it, and somebody's just going to duck to the side. So this is a recognition of the ways we cause suffering for ourselves, and the way our own reactivity can cause suffering elsewhere. And the way that this becomes the source of compassion is seeing how true this is of us, seeing how much we get caught up in what's sometimes called our endless blind passions, and how easily, despite our best intentions, despite our bodhisattva vows to cut through all delusions, to cut through the endless arising of these things, still they keep coming. And we see how true that is for us, and we see how hard it is for us to act skillfully, and this actually becomes this realization becomes part of the what enables us to be more flexible and more kind and more compassionate towards others when they are acting unskillfully, when they are acting angrily towards us, when they are acting harmfully towards the world. We're able to look at that and go, yeah, yeah, I know where that comes from. And being able to meet beings where they are and recognize that we are just like that. That is what's meant by kindness in Buddhism. That is the root of compassion, is this fellow feeling, is this recognizing that that suffering is just like my suffering, and I know how hard that must be. This Buddha, the source of compassion, this Buddha receives only compassion. How wonderful that would be, right? What if everywhere we went, all we ever received is compassion from all those other beings out there? But in this chant, that's what we're saying happens. How does that happen? There's kind of like a magical transmutation that happens. That when this Buddha becomes the source of compassion, when this awakening to how we get caught up in our own energies of grasping, aversion, and certainty, when we are able to recognize that, and when we're able to see these energies arising for us in response to what people do, in response to what comes at us, everything that comes in becomes an opportunity to see, oh, so here's this energy arising for me, on the one hand. And it becomes an opportunity to practice compassion by being able to know that here is a suffering being, suffering just exactly like we do so often. And then even harsh words, even unkindness, becomes something that reconnects us potentially to our compassion, something that points out to us the places where we are creating suffering for ourselves. And recognizing this doesn't mean that we just roll over and take it in all circumstances. This means that we're able to respond skillfully and usefully in whatever is the most skillful and relevant way to circumstances, to people, rather than just being so close to our anger that anger comes up and we react angrily. So anger still comes up because we still remain human in this path. But when it does, we have more choice in how we meet this person. And that means, and we're able to see our things happening. Sometimes. And whether it happens in the moment, or 5 minutes later, or a day later, or 6 years later, when you see that thing that happened, that's still receiving only compassion. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, just compassion. So this is kind of saying that the whole of the Buddhist path, the whole places of refuge in awakening, refuge which is the Buddha, refuge in the universe as it in fact is, and the teachings that point us to that, which is the Dharma, and refuge in the community of people who are together walking this path. All of this is expressions of compassion. All of this is pointing us towards compassion, towards absorbing world sounds. And remember, so in this chant, the compassion is absorbing world sounds, beholding the cries of the world, beholding suffering, receiving this difficult moment as it is. That's the whole of the path. The Dalai Lama, for instance, says, and Tibetan Buddhism often teaches that the people who kind of cause us the most grief are actually doing us an enormous kindness, because if everyone were only ever nice to us, we would never have the opportunity to practice these things and to cultivate these states of mind, or to cultivate these skills which are able to find and connect to the liberating quality of this moment as it is, by providing us the kind of necessary requirement that we wake up to it. And in that way, our enemies are our best friends. thus, the pure heart always rejoices. And this rejoicing is another word for meeting this moment as it is. And in this discipline, in this practice of meeting this moment as it is, turning towards ourselves, turning towards our lives, turning towards our experience as it is, we find that there is a kind of fundamental okayness, even in difficulty. There is a kind of fundamental enoughness, even in pain. And thus the pure heart always rejoices. And rejoicing is kind of what naturally arises in by kind of receiving gratefully all that's out there and all that's in here. In the light, recall this. In the dark, recall this. Sometimes this is translated in the morning, recall this. And in the evening, recall this. And that's evocative here in with light and dark. But there's another thing that is going on here in this kind of language, which is that when your mind is all illuminated and you're really feeling that vivid joy arising, or you're really seeing how thoughts and all that arise for you are just thoughts and things arising rather than things that are inherent truth, you're able to receive those mental formations just as they are. That's the light. And in the dark, too, when we forget. Yeah. In the dark, when our hearts are feeling closed and tight, we don't need to force that closed and tight heart open. But even just turning towards and receiving our own hard-heartedness is how, in the dark, we recall this truth. Moment after moment, the true heart arises. Time after time, there is nothing but this. Moment after moment, the true heart arises. And the true heart isn't something you need to go out looking for. This thing that's arising for you now, in each moment, that is the true heart. Moment after moment, turning towards what is, turning towards what's here now, we find the true heart. And it arises naturally. We don't have to do anything, manufacture anything, get to some special state of mind. Just turning towards, beholding, absorbing the cries of the world, absorbing what is, we see that the true heart arises. Time after time, there is nothing but this. And this is another name for the universe itself, another name for the Dharma itself, another name for the continuously unfolding process of awakening itself, is this. And when we turn towards our experience, when we turn towards receiving and allowing, we find that it's all here. Everything we need, everything we think we lack is all here, but not in the way that we imagine. And time after time, what's revealed is that we only have this. Just this is it. One of my old former teachers, Zen teachers, used to have a seal that said, "Just this is it." But because he was a kind of closed-handed, secret-holding kind of guy, it said it in ancient Chinese. But even so, just this is it. And we see this, we see glimmers of this over and over and over again, and the only thing we see is that just this is it. Just this and it's enough. Just this. Somebody came in to see me in Doksan interviews a few weeks ago, and he's been practicing for around 10 years or something like that. And he said, "Josh, it's just this. It's really just this. Just this is it." You know, and we hear this over and over and over again, and we're like, yeah, just this. I don't know, whatever that means. Just this is it. Obviously, this is not it. This is just me, so this can't be it. And we hear it over and over again, and eventually we see for ourselves, oh, just this is it. And then we see it, and then we grab onto that. Yeah, just that over there was it. That was totally it. Yeah, I just need to get back there. And then, again, eventually it arises that we see, oh, right, not that over there. This, here, just this is it. And there is a kindness, a softening, an opening that comes from beholding the cries of the world, from absorbing the sounds of the world, from gently and intimately meeting ourselves and seeing that just this is. So that's my little explication of our new English version of the Canungio. And I want to open up the floor for comments or responses or questions or complaints.
When you talk about responding skillfully and compassionately, I get the impression that it's not always nice.
Right. It's not always anything. Right. And this is the first truth of Buddhism, right? Impermanence. Things change. And so it's not always anything. It varies according to time, place, position, degree, relationship, circumstance. And so being able to let that vary rather than so from a certain standpoint, responding always nice is just as bound up in habit energy and unfreedom as responding always by meeting anger with anger. And so, the real invitation here is to be able to see what's arising for you, and in light of that, and see what this circumstance is, and respond in the way that, to the best of your limited perspective and ability, is most apparently useful. And we don't always get this right. Right? And nothing about Buddhist practice, Zen practice, makes you always get it right in every circumstance. It just starts to give you more flexibility so that you can maybe get lucky a little more often. And all of this comes from having space around our habit energy, our built up kind of the karmic ruts we've worn in our mind, and turning towards suffering, turning towards our difficulty, is a practice that kind of shovels a bit of dirt back into those ruts worn into our mind, so that it's more of a smooth thing that we can turn and adjust courses on. Because when we're stuck in a rut, all we can do is keep forward going in that rut.
Josh, this translation is rather different from the one we have been using for the past decade. Do you have any background information on, you know, how this translation and the other translation came about, and the translator's intents in introducing it?
So I think this one is more of an interpretation rather than a translation. The other one was kind of a translation, but it was also kind of opaque. But there's a lot of lines that kind of didn't really pull at one's heart, and so this one kind of gives more entrees into opening and as to the translator's intent beyond that, I can't exactly speak to this, but I think that this translation, I think, comes from Kaz Tanahashi, who's a translator of Dogen and a Zen teacher, and the folks I first encountered this one in a Zen monastery in Oregon. This is a interpretation that kind of gives us an opportunity to touch the heart of what's going on in this chant.
So when Kevin said, I forgot exactly what he said, that it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to react one way or another, and Josh, you said it doesn't mean you're going to get it right. So the word right caught me. Because we don't know what's right, do we? I mean, could you explain more about when you were responding to Kevin, what you meant by right? Because that to me said, okay, then there was a wrong, and then I got twisted up with where Kevin started with. Right?
Yeah, so Kevin was pointing kind of at the same thing that you are, but going in a different way. So what you're saying, that we don't know what's right. Right. This is actually the functioning of the mind of wisdom. This is the antidote to delusional certainty, recognizing that we don't know. We're only all just doing our best and showing up to our lives as they are, our minds as they are. We're doing what we can. We're returning to our aspirations to save all beings, and we're returning to our aspirations to follow these guidelines of the precepts. But even so, there's no knowing what's right. There's only trying to return to the intention to act with kindness.
So we always get it right.
That's right. In an important way, that's true. And for those of us who are so habitually used to telling ourselves the story of, man, I got that so wrong. God, I'm not enough. God, I just can't do this. I'm not cut out for this. This thing that you're pointing to of we always get it right is a really deep practice, and it's a practice of entrusting. And it's also the liberating practice of failure. And that's one sign. In Zen, sadly, there's always another side as well, which they're both always true, even when they're in conflict. So what I was speaking to with Kevin is that just because we're turning toward this moment, just because we're seeing our own reactivity arising and we're trying to say, okay, so I've got some reactivity arising, what do I want to do with that? It doesn't mean then that everything then is roses. It doesn't mean that everything just unfolds perfectly and there's no conflict. But what it does mean is that we have an opportunity to, in the middle of that conflict, let even the wrong be right. And it means that we have a little more flexibility in the ranges of responses we can consider. And it doesn't mean we have some supernatural power to know what the most skillful thing in the circumstance ever is. All we can do is the best we can. And as you're pointing out, we're always doing that.
I wanted to say, I had some other specific idea when I asked the question, and you very skillfully pulled the rug out from under my idea, which was good. I think I was thinking about enabling and, you know, sort of the tough love kind of thing. And when you said to not be just one thing, but be responsive to what's really going on at each moment, that opens me up. But there's another thing in there that I just got this now, I think, which is that not only that, it's also a call to action as opposed to inaction, to be actively compassionate. Because in the particular thing I was thinking about, my wife and I often avoid dealing with a particular problem. And turning to face it, there's that call to action. And, you know, yes, so sometimes we'll get it right, sometimes we'll get it wrong, but it's better to turn and face it. And
right, and that right and wrong is actually on a less primary level than the rightness of turning towards it. Right, or
causing more or less harm.
and whether you cause less harm because you found a path through the minefield, or making your best effort, you end up causing harm anyhow, is in a way secondary to the fact that your intention there was being present, was seeing what's arising, and recognizing that you and all beings suffer by getting caught in greed, anger, and ignorance, doing the best you can. That's the primary thing. And whether you make it all the way through the minefield unexploded is actually not the most important thing. Which means that there's, which is actually a great comfort, right?
Hmm.
Yeah.
I'm going to need to hear this again. Will I be able to hear this again?
If all of this worked right.
If it works.
It looks like it's going. So, and it will be up on the website whenever Kevin puts it up on the website. No, on that Hank website first. Yeah. Al?
I just wanted to go back to briefly to something you said towards the beginning of your talk, which was that, of course, bodhisattva compassion, kanapanya, is a quality in us. And yeah, of course. And also, I just wanted to say that something that I found more and more recently is that it's wonderful that we have these qualities that are in us, externalized for us sometimes in these images and in these ideas, you know, these characters that we give the bodhisattvas. I think I resisted that a lot early in my Zen life and wanted a very kind of austere Protestant Zen with no altars and no idols and, you know, very iconoclastic. And I found, as I've gotten older, that it can be really inspiring, maybe just as a way to focus our attention or focus our intention, to have these beautiful externalized images with these lovely stories and characters that we give them.
Yeah, and part of what you're pointing to there is really, really vividly is the place where it stops being so important. Is it inside? Is it outside? When I'm invoking it, is it there? Is it here? When looking there reminds me of this, where is that? And all of that is kind of a piece. Yeah. Which is another way to meet it. Yeah. Perfect. Thank you.
So before you talk, when we were chanting this, I found myself thinking that I don't like it because you were talking about ruts and it felt kind of rut-like with words like only and just and always and yeah. So I mean, initially I really, even though I'm just a little bit familiar with the last one,
mm-hmm.
I found myself already kind of defensive about that and not really liking this, but the last one is still the same.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing but this, and then your talk kind of changed it a bit,
mm-hmm.
Made it more about what the words were saying than the words themselves.
Yeah.
I like in the light and in the dark.
Yeah.
Because it's no matter.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah.
And those three words that you pulled out, only, just, and always. You know, so there's other ways to hear them. There's a way to hear them of only this, just this, where it's very restrictive, where it's saying not that and not that. And I think that there's another way to hear it, which is really simply this, seriously, just this, just this. And it's a kind of welcoming, that just this is a welcoming of all of this kind of myriad ordinariness, rather than picking out just this and saying just this. And always, and that always, another way of hearing that, so the restrictive way of hearing that is always rejoices. You will rejoice right now. and the kind of more spacious way to hear it is kind of like reliably. This is something that you can count on. By in the light turning towards this, in the dark turning towards this, you can reliably find this enoughness, this okayness. And that's the always. So that's really well perceived on your part. Thank you for that. Did you have a question?
No. If I can engage in a bit of commentary. This process of changing sutra books, I think, brings out interesting experiences. You know, for example, we've been chanting this chant the same way for a decade now. And you know, already some of us are showing some attachment to it. Yeah. And it is interesting, you know, feeling these attachments. I recall reading somewhere in one of the discourses of the Buddha, he actually recommended against chanting practice because people would become attached to the chant. And one thing we know about human psychology is the first time we're ever exposed to something, you know, like a particular chant, we think this is the right way. All right? And then, yeah, that's the model, that's the template, and everything else that comes after it is compared to that template. And it's, in many cases, just random chance that you heard it that way in the beginning as opposed to some other way. There's also a lovely Russian saying. Don't expect your monastery's rules to be followed in other monasteries when you're visiting.
Good advice. And I want to say, although Sue very generously gave me credit for having done a lot of the work to prepare this new edition of the Boundless Way Sutra book, this actually comes from all of the Boundless Way teachers. It's not my fault. Pursuant Doug's comment about you shouldn't do chanting practices, I'd like to close with an additional chant. So before we go to the four vows, I want to, from page 20, do the chanted version of the Nembutsu. And the Nembutsu is a expression of oneness between, of this, our limited, karmically habit pattern filled selves and Amida Buddha, the Buddha of compassion, the ocean of light pervading everywhere. So we're going to do this chant 6 times, and I will do the first one by myself, then we'll dive in for 5 more, and we'll close with a bow followed by the four Bodhisattva vows. And this chant is not a chant of meaning. It is a chant of doing. And it's just, it's as this thing that Arlene read at the beginning from our Dharma ancestor, beginning our sutra service, I vow with all beings to join my voice with all voices and give life to each word as it comes. That's part of the practice here. So, Bob, there's a bell on the first boo.
But it's all six times.
But we're going to chant it six times. There's only a total of two bells.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah.
Oh, just one.
Okay. Those two things marked there. No.
No.